tradition, son Harry Burkhart allegedly set 49 fires between December 29th and January 2nd. They caused extensive damage in several neighborhoods. He's facing 100 felony charges. A Los Angeles magistrate agreed that Dorothy Burkhart could be extradited to her home country, although no date for the extradition has been set. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Emmy Award-winning comedy writer Al Gordon reportedly has died. The Los Angeles Times cites Gordon's son, Neil, saying his father passed away yesterday at a Los Angeles area hospital at the age of 89. Gordon's contributions are legendary. He spent much of his career working with comic Jack Benny, and he also wrote for the Smothers Brothers, Flip Wilson, and Carol Burnett. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Perata talks about his novel, The Leftovers, which was just published in paperback. It's about those left behind grieving after many people instantaneously disappear in what may or may not be the rapture.
This is an agnostics apocalypse where even this event that should make everything clear just makes it all murky.
Perata also wrote Election and Little Children. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. Com Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour, we will again go to the Focus archives. This is a program that we first broadcast in April of last year. So as you listen, do keep in mind that for this hour, we'll not take calls. My guest this morning in this hour of the show is Tina Rosenberg. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's made something of a specialty of writing about seemingly intractable problems. Her books include Children of Cain, Violence and the Violent in Latin America, and also The Haunted Land, Facing Europe's Ghosts After Communism. That book won the National Book Award. And in a new book that we'll be talking about, and the title of that book is Join the Club, she takes a look at the ways that we have approached particular serious social problems and how we have tried to solve them, things like drug use or sexually transmitted disease. And typically what we have done is that we have tried to motivate people either by giving them information or through scaring them. She, however, in this book, tells stories about people who have used a very different approach, one that's based on changing behavior by exploiting a basic human need, and that is the need to belong. Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World is the book. It's published by Norton. It is just out, and we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in the book. In addition to her books, she writes the Fixes column online for the New York Times. She also writes for the New York Times Magazine and other publications, and she is joining us this morning by phone. Now, as we talk, questions are welcome. And Ms. Rosenberg, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's nice to be here.
Well, just to talk about a couple of things first off, I think probably there are a lot of people who, when they hear those two words, peer pressure, don't have a positive association with it. And they no doubt think about how peer pressure can, particularly when it comes to young people and risky behavior, can really be a problem. That is, it gets people to do, it leads people to do things they should not, rather than leading them to do things that they should.
Well, I'm a parent myself, so I completely understand that point of view. I think you're right. I mean, we are very much used to thinking of peer pressure as something that's purely negative. But the point that I make in my book is that it's an extremely powerful force. We all know that. And if we try, we can turn that powerful force to more positive ends. And one example that I think people know about, and this might have been the only one I would have been able to think of a couple years ago, is Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a group of people who are all trying to do the same thing as you, and you meet periodically, and you hold each other accountable, and you support each other, and that's how you change. And that's the basic idea that I apply in the book. I tell the stories of people who are applying it in various fields, personal behaviors like addictions, but also really, really wide issues. For example, peer pressure helped to bring down Slobodan Milosevic in Yugoslavia.
Yeah, that's really it's really interesting. First of all, that there are many examples where you can show that it works, or just in the case of Alcoholics Anonymous, how it's striking how that template, how well it has been applied to so many other sorts of things. And what really seems to make the big difference is that people aren't alone. They're part of a group. They can support each other, monitor each other, talk about their experiences, and that's a very powerful force.
That's right. I mean, it's just really a basic part of being human, is that we really desire the respect of a group and the sense of belonging to a group. And some of the forms this can take are meetings, like Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's other forms it can take. Can I give you an example?
Sure.
Of a program that's been the only successful thing we've ever done to keep teens from taking up smoking?
Mm-hmm.
Back in the late 1990s, teen smoking was really epidemically high. 36.5% of all high school seniors smoked, astronomical figures. And we had tried telling kids how dangerous smoking was, and we had tried scaring them, as you said, showing them pictures of gravestones, and none of that worked. In fact, nobody knew what to do at the time. And then Florida tried something new. It hired an advertising agency, one that had never done any public health work but had done marketing to teenagers. And this ad agency sat down and said, let's think about why teenagers smoke. For a teenager, a cigarette is not a delivery system for nicotine. It's a delivery system for rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Teens smoke because it makes them feel autonomous. It allows them to tell the adults in their lives, you don't tell me what to do. It makes them feel cool. Their friends think of them as cool. So the ad agency said, let's find a way that we can give teens those same feelings, but by not smoking. So they designed a campaign that had both clubs and TV ads. And the theme of the campaign was, tell those tobacco companies to stop manipulating us. It was rebellion against the tobacco companies. And the ads, they were just brilliant. They were designed by teenagers, and they showed teens making prank phone calls, for example, to advertising agencies that did tobacco company ads. They filmed a road trip. A bunch of kids drove from Florida up to Richmond, Virginia, which is the headquarters of Philip Morris. And they stopped at the gate and they asked the guard, can we talk to the Marlboro man? And the guard, clueless man, said, oh, he's dead. And in fact, the actor who played him in the commercials had just died of lung cancer. And they got all this on tape and they put it on the air. And teenagers just thought this was great. And then they could supplement these TV ads with these clubs kids could join, which were not against smoking and not against smokers, but they staged pranks and actions in street theater against the tobacco companies.
Yeah.
This was hugely successful. The next 2 years, Florida had the biggest drop in teen smoking rates that we had ever seen in the United States. And then the strategy went national, and from 1997 to 2007, many states, including Florida, saw their teen smoking rates cut by half.
So here is the powerful thing is that you're getting people to identify with it, rather than to identify with the group that smokes and everything that's involved with that, you're getting them to identify it with a different group, and that is the group norm becomes not smoking.
Right, and it's important that it's not a group of goody-goodies. It's a group of rebels.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to make not smoking into something that's cool, so kids can see themselves as cool and think of themselves as belonging to a cool group.
Just for a second, I want to go back to the other kind of approach, and this is the thing that appeals to our reason, the idea that you should be able to appeal to reason. And for just take smoking, for example, the idea we somehow think that we should be able to take our kids and sit down with them and take them by the hand and say, look, come on now. We really everybody knows we have all this evidence. Smoking is really bad for you. You know, you can do that. And then you can do the other thing. You can show them pictures of diseased lungs and you can say, look at this. This is what, if you smoke, your lungs are going to look like this. Well, it doesn't. We feel that it should work. It clearly does not.
David, do you know that teenagers actually overestimate the dangers of smoking?
Oh, that just makes it even better.
Yeah, they think it's actually more dangerous than it is. That's part of its appeal.
Mm-hmm. But that, I guess that's still, I find myself wishing that that kind of approach did work, or thinking that it should, and wondering, well, why is it that the appeal to reason, that kind of appeal to reason, I mean, it sometimes it does work, and maybe it would work better with an adult than with a teenager, but I find myself wondering, well, why is it that that doesn't work?
Well, because what motivates us, the most powerful thing that motivates us is identification, is having people who we respect who are doing something and we say, I want to be like them. That's what motivates us. People don't get motivated by having new information. I mean, is there anybody who doesn't realize that Big Macs are fattening? Is there anybody who doesn't realize that smoking is bad for you? That's not how we change ourselves.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Tina Rosenberg. She's a journalist. She has won the Pulitzer Prize. She's written about political violence in Latin America and the aftermath of communism in Europe, and is the author of a new book that looks at how peer pressure can transform the world. That's the subtitle, and the title of the book is Join the Club. It's published by W.W. Norton, in which she talks about something that she calls the social cure, which involves using positive peer pressure to help people change their behavior. And she says that not only can that lead individuals to change their behavior, but can bring about larger societal change. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, just to give an example of how this can really change things on a societal level, just earlier in the conversation, you talked about Serbia. And in the book, you talk about a Serbian student movement that eventually got big enough so that it led to a change at the top in the government of Serbia. But it took advantage of the same kind of thing that was an important feature of the design of the program that you just talked about, to try to get teenagers not to smoke.
That's right. The movement was called Otpor, which means resistance in Serbian. And it was started in 1998 by 11 students at Belgrade University who got together in a cafe and said, we're going to overthrow Slobodan Milosevic. Everyone thought they were insane, of course. And I've seen democracy movements now in probably two dozen countries. I've lived in two dictatorships. What these kids did was something I had never seen before. This is really something new and fresh to me. They sat down and they said, what is it that we need to do in order to get people to overthrow Milosevic? We don't need to give them information about what a lousy dictatorship they live in. Serbs already know that. We don't need to appeal to fear, because they're already terrified. That's one reason they don't want to participate. What we need to do is motivate them. And the way to motivate them to come out of their houses and get involved in political activity was by making this movement the cool club that everybody wanted to join. Just like the kids in Florida, they used humor, they used pranks, they used street theater. They did not do speeches. They said speeches are just going to turn people off. They did not use marches, because they were very small at the time. What they did was grow their movement slowly by using these kinds of tactics. And they really changed Serbs' attitudes about their own ability to participate in politics. And they allowed kids to join. And they could really be brave. They, you know, everybody knew they would get arrested, but you'd spend two or three or maybe 8 hours in the police station, and you'd come out of the police station at night, and there would be this crowd of cheering supporters and opposition journalists, and you'd give some interviews, and then you'd go out and have beer with your friends and tell them your stories of what happened, and you'd go back to school the next day, and everybody wants your phone number. It was so cool to be in this group that kids start to compete to get arrested. I met one young man in the city of Novi Sad who'd been arrested at least 17 times. And gradually it grew. They went from 11 students in the fall of 1998 to 70,000 people 2 years later, actually probably more than that. They had to stop counting because they couldn't register people as fast as they were coming in. And Milosevic fell.
Well, I'm sure that right away, though, the people will say, well, yes, I guess that's one example where this can work. But they would, I'm sure, point to many, many other places. You've probably been some of them, where if you acted out like this and you did something to criticize the government and you were picked up by the police, you might be never seen again.
Yes, that is true. But there's two answers to that question. One is there's a surprising number of places where you actually would be in the police station for 2 or 3 hours and then get let go. I mean, we may hear about the dictatorships that respond to protests by shooting their protesters, but there's many semi-repressive countries that don't, that are more like Serbia. And in fact, the kids in this group formed an organization that now goes around the world teaching democracy movements how to use these tactics. The other thing I would say is that, and this is something that they talk about a lot, is that when if they had started out in Serbia 10 years before, they would have been met with shooting and with tanks in the streets, because that's how Milosevic responded to the protests that took place in 1991. The country gradually conquered more political space. Political space is never granted. It's always conceded because people make the dictator concede it. So if you think of this as a long march and not as an overnight thing, you can win the political space little by little to do things like this.
And I think that some of these people who had gone on to teach others how to do this had had contact with people who were involved in Egypt and
That's
were
right.
part of the movement that that unseated Hosni
Mubarak.
Yeah.
That's right. They among the groups they trained was the April 6th movement in Egypt, which was one of the most influential in designing the protests. And, for example, one of the things that the April 6th movement learned from Atpour was use humor, don't be threatening, make friends with the police, treat them as allies in waiting. And, you know, obviously you don't adopt tactics completely. You have to make them fit your local circumstances. But this was these strategies that Atpour used were extremely influential in Egypt.
Right. We have a caller we'll talk with in Effingham. We'll go right there, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, David. Your guest seems to be rather young. I don't know that, but her articulation and the how she is thinking. Two questions. Please have her explain what she thinks democracy is and where does it exist?
Wow, what a question. What I think democracy is the ability of people to choose their own leaders and where it exists. You know, the list is very long, and there's not a bright line between democracy and dictatorship. There are many countries that have a little bit of both.
Okay, and what you just described was not just democracy, but republicanism. A republic. A republic is a far cry from democracy. Now, that's a representative government.
Okay, in the political science definition, you may be right. But what I'm talking about is democracy the way we tend to define it when we look at what the different political systems of the world
But the term is deceptive in its articulation and is indicative of hiding republicanism or the republic behind the term democracy. When we're going to vote here in Effingham. Tomorrow, and we are going to elect 5 people to the city council and a new mayor, and the county board, there's open seats on that. But those people, 5 people, I always use the city council as a perfect example, that 5 people have the final say by a 3-vote majority, so it can actually be 3 people who institute the policies and the continuity of a Republican ideal, and that is not democracy.
I think we're really not that what the caller has to say is irrelevant and important. It's a different kind of a show, but let me come back to the topic that we started talking about, and maybe you would like the opportunity to talk a little bit more about places that you have seen real political change, people really being involved in politics, and where they again used some of the thing that we're talking about here.
Well, sure. Right after the fall of Milosevic, activists from many countries started getting in touch with these young Serbs, and they prefer to work with new groups. They don't like to work with existing political groups. They feel that very often under a dictatorship, even the opposition parties have sort of settled into a comfortable coexistence, and they're in some ways tainted. Many people in many dictatorships are just as disgusted with the behavior of the democratic opposition as they are with the government. So they prefer to work with young student groups. And the first two who contacted them were a group of Georgians in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia and a group of students in the Ukraine. And in both cases, people from Otpor spent a lot of time in those countries advising these movements. They had the ear of the leadership. The groups in both cases, Georgia's was called Kamara and Ukraine's was called Pora, which were Otpor-like names, and they used versions of the Otpor fist as their logo. And they adopted these tactics, very, very, very thoroughly. And they worked. In Georgia, this brought about the Rose Revolution, and in Ukraine, the Orange Revolution.
Well, I guess I come back to the idea that if for change to occur, for a person to be involved in change, you can't be the lone voice crying out in the wilderness. It can't work that way. Somehow you have to put yourself together in a network of like-minded individuals.
Right. You grow slowly. I mean, you don't try and stage a mass movement on your first month. But you can do things like these tactics they used, the street theater, that made your movement look bigger than it was. And that they took advantage of that. I mean, they had a lot of graffiti going on, and once you put something up on a wall, it stays there for a while. So one person can do an awful lot of graffiti. And they really sought to make the movement from the very beginning look like it had more than the 11 people who started it. Mm-hmm. And this builds on itself. But you have to have patience and you have to have organization.
We're getting close to our midpoint here. I want to thank the caller. I want to invite others. 323-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You can write us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. This is Focus. I'm David Inge, and my guest this morning is Tina Rosenberg. She was the first freelance journalist to receive a MacArthur Fellowship. She writes the Fixes online column for the New York Times and also writes for the New York Times Magazine and other publications. She is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She's the author of the book Children of Cain, Violence and the Violent in Latin America, and the National Book Award-winning Haunted Land, Facing Europe's Ghosts After Communism. Her new book is Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World, and the publisher of the book is W.W. Norton. So questions are welcome. We started out, the very first example that you gave had to do with trying to persuade teenagers not to smoke. So the kind of thing that we're talking about here, I'm sure that a lot of people right away when they think about peer pressure, they think about young people and about how peer pressure can sometimes be problematic. And here you give an example of the way that peer pressure can actually be something positive. Let me give you a chance to talk about another example and another problematic behavior, and that is high-risk sexual behavior. One of the movements that you profiled was one in South Africa, where what they did was they were working with young people, and there again, the interest was to get people not to have high risk sex as a way of trying to limit the spread of HIV.
That's right. They South Africa had not had a very serious AIDS prevention policy before this group started. They had a lot to do. I mean, they had just come out of apartheid, and this was not on the top of their to-do list. But South Africa did decide to start one around the same time that Florida had its anti-smoking movement. And again, luckily, they had people in charge of it who understood advertising and what motivates teenagers. And again, they sat down and said, do teenagers in South Africa need information about how they're catching HIV and what its devastating effects are? No, they all know that. What they need is a reason to apply that information to themselves. People knew what risky behavior was, but they did not see any reason for them to avoid risky behavior. They did not feel like they had much of a future, and so they felt like, well, geez, let's just live for the present. So what they did was they started a group called Love Life, which is a deliberate play on words, and it did very little actual talking about HIV. If you went to Love Life's website, it looks like an online fashion magazine. It talks about gossip and dating advice and pop stars and actors and fashion. And the idea was to give kids a club to join that made them feel like they were a part of something. And they also recruited thousands of kids as, they called them groundbreakers. And they were trained in motivational speaking and sent into schools to talk about how they had changed their own lives how they had started out as someone who didn't feel that they had much of a future and took a lot of risks, but then realized they had so much to live for and started to behave in a way that helped them preserve their health. And this was slow, but it has been very successful. South Africa has seen a 55% drop in the rate of new infections between 2005 and 2008. Now, a lot of countries have been seeing drops in the infection rate for HIV as the epidemics mature, but South Africa's has been far greater than any others. And we don't know for a fact that the reason is Love Life, but it is likely it is. It is the biggest national AIDS prevention program and the only one that's aimed just at teenagers.
Let's talk with another caller. Champagne is on line one. Hello.
Yes, it's me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, in the first place, I want to congratulate her. It's a very interesting subject, and I think that will be great if our kids can join something like that, because right now I have a teenager daughter, and you are so right about how they want to fit in some group. Sometimes they go for the wrong way, so if we get something in the same way that makes them so interested, maybe we can get very good results. And the second thing I want to comment is about the gentleman is about democracy. Just one thing. What means people, like the people of the town or the city, and kratos means power, so it's the power of the people. So I believe we are in the right track about democracy, the power of the people. Thank you. That's it.
All right.
David, I wonder if you wouldn't mind repeating those questions. I had a little trouble hearing what she was saying.
Well, I mean, first of all, she said that she just really liked some of the examples that you gave, because she said that she had a teenage daughter. And she understands perfectly well the idea that for people of that age, they really want to belong. They want to fit in, so that if you can take advantage of that as for example, the anti-smoking or the anti-risky sexual behavior programs do take advantage of people's wanting to belong, that really works. I mean, I think she was saying that sounds like a great approach. I was a little bit maybe less clear, but I think that she was sort of making a positive statement in favor of democracy, at least that we do have a system where people are encouraged. They do have the opportunity to be involved in their communities, and I guess it's just up to them to step up and do it. Now, whether, you know, the previous caller would like the old Athenian democracy where everybody just gets together in one place, you know, we have an amphitheater and everybody gets to have their say and then they take a vote. I don't know.
We can't even get people to vote in this country, much less come to an amphitheater to make all relevant government decisions.
Really? Do you have a peer pressure program for getting people to vote?
You know, that's a really good idea.
Make it cool to vote?
I don't see why that wouldn't work. I mean, Rock the Vote was sort of an attempt to do that. Do you remember Rock
the Vote? Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And the Obama campaign's field operation, which was massive, I think the single largest field operation in American electoral history, relied a little bit on peer pressure. I mean, I was told by people who were volunteers that to actually go into the Obama field offices on the weekend and do stuff in the company of other people who were also volunteering made you feel good, and the racial component was a big part of it. I mean, African Americans could feel great about what they were doing and feel proud, and also whites who went into work also felt great about what they were doing and felt proud. So I think there was a component of that. I don't want to be designing a program off the top of my head, but I don't see why a Join the Club strategy couldn't be used for getting people to the voting booth. Mm.
Well, and I think that we have talked about a number of examples. Some of them are programs or movements that are designed to appeal to young people. But one of the very first things you mentioned was Alcoholics Anonymous, mm-hmm. and its model, and then how that model can be applied to other things. So I guess I'm getting around to the idea that anybody who would think that these kind of strategies work best or would only work for adolescents or young people, well, I think I'm sure, find examples where adults whether we're talking about people who are wrestling with substance abuse or whether we're talking about people who really want to be involved in politics, where these kinds of things, the same sorts of things, help to reinforce the positive behaviors and that they work just as well for grown-ups as they do for kids.
Well, I think that's a very good point. There are reasons to think that teens are more susceptible to peer pressure than adults. I mean, the teenage brain is still in formation, and it won't surprise any parents to know that the judgment, the part of the brain that regulates judgment, is one of the last things to mature. So a lot of teenagers are somewhat shakier on that. Teens haven't yet found the peer group that makes them comfortable, and they're trying a bunch of different new ones. I mean, one of the qualities of being an adult in a country where there's a lot of mobility like ours is you can find the peer group that makes you comfortable. So you stop thinking of it as peer pressure because that's what you want to do. But adults are susceptible to peer pressure. And let me give you an example that I think is hugely important right now as Americans think about how we can solve some of the problems the deficiencies of our healthcare system. And that is patient adherence. We are notoriously bad at following the programs that doctors lay out for us. We are terrible at taking our pills on time, and all of us are. That doesn't vary by social class or level of education. Even medical students are terrible about taking their pills on time. And we're even worse about things like reforming our behavior to live more healthfully, to exercise more, change our diets, et cetera. So what do we do about this? This is a problem that's responsible for untold amounts of death and sickness and billions of dollars in unnecessary health care costs. There is a program, a strategy that works, and it is in use in most of the world except the United States, and it's called DOTS, which stands for Directly Observed Treatment. And it was invented as a way to help people who had tuberculosis stick with a six-month course of medication, because it's really hard to take your pills for 6 months, especially after you start to feel better and they have bad side effects, so you tend to quit. But DOTS, what DOTS does is it recruits somebody to be your pill buddy. It could be a friend, a family member, or a community health worker, and they come to your house every day and watch you swallow your pills. And it turns out that people who are not good at swallowing their pills on their own are very good at it when they have somebody sitting down and saying, okay, time to take your pills now. When DOTS was introduced in China, cure rates for tuberculosis in the areas where DOTS was working went from 50% to 94%. It's just had a stunning effect on TB. And there's no reason that a form of it couldn't be adapted to the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, we get pill bottles that say take with food on them. Why can't we get a pill bottle that says take with spouse or take with child? Because I know my kids would love this job. And it's something that could really help us to improve our health. And it's something that is, in many cases, free.
Yeah. Well, this is a less profound example, but I'm sure that people have heard the advice. Say you have someone who you're interested in really trying to change your life, become more healthy, exercise, lose some weight. They say, well, you need to go out and get yourself an exercise buddy.
That's
because
right.
there are going to be those days when you're going to wake up and you're going to say, I cannot do it. I cannot put my shoes on and go out walking or running or do push-ups or, you know, whatever it is. And it can be very helpful to have that other person say, come on, come on, come on, get up, put your shoes on, we're going. And that there's got to be some time where hopefully each person will do that for the other. But when you can't motivate yourself, it can be really helpful to have somebody else who is, you know, jabbing you and say, okay,
That's
come on,
right.
We're going.
All diets work if you stick to them. Problem is how to stick to them, and this is one way.
We're coming into about our last 15 minutes here on Focus. I'm David Inge. Tina Rosenberg is the guest, and we're talking about what you will find in her book, Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. Norton is the publisher. You know, I think, and I've read a number of reviews of the book, and I think a lot of people made the point. They referenced your previous work
mm-hmm.
and the kinds of things that you had written about. And as I mentioned, you've written about people trying to get things sorted out in Europe after the fall of communism, and you've written about violence in Latin America. And I think a lot of people said, well, why this book? You know, what for someone with your background, why was it that after that you decided that you wanted to write this?
Well, I had become more interested in writing about people who were solving social problems after spending a good part of my career writing about the problems themselves. And I realized I had done a story that was in part about the Love Life program in South Africa, and I was starting work on a story about Otpor in Serbia, and it struck me that these were essentially the same strategy. I was writing the same story over and over again, and they don't seem like they would be because, you know, one of them is the South Africa program is government-sponsored, and it's supposed to change your personal behavior. And the Serbian movement was definitely not sponsored by the government, about as far from it as you can get, and it was trying to change something that was a very, very wide issue in the society. But they were really, at bottom, the same strategy. So I decided to write this book because I felt like, Jesus, this is something that works where other things haven't worked, and I wanted to connect the dots.
And that's, I guess I find myself, again, going back to the smoking example. That was, in fact, a government program.
Yes,
but,
it was.
But it doesn't necessarily, the Otpor says, well, this can be a kind of a grassroots thing. It can work either way.
There's examples in my book of government programs and of programs started by one lone visionary or a small group of creative people. Mm-hmm. It's really something that you can do on your own. You raise the example of exercise. You know, if you get serious about exercise and you want to form a group of one other person or two other people, you can do that on your own. Or bureaucracies can use this to, as they did in Florida.
I wonder too whether a book like this is a kind of book that gets written by somebody who has been in places where there has been a lot of conflict and when there are a lot of problems and where you see things being bad for a long time and not getting better, and partly it comes from being encouraged by seeing something that's positive and wanting to either wanting to write about that or wanting to find out more about that.
Well, I'm sorry to say that one can certainly find examples of intractable, serious problems in the United States as well.
I have to talk about something else because I think, again, this is interesting in the sense that it tells you what sort of conditions have to apply to have people come together. And I'm thinking of the Willow Creek Church and about the fact that they had programs. And that they were trying to put together, I guess, what I would call affinity groups in the sense, you know, people who had the same kind of experiences or were the same place in their life. And that that really didn't work very well. But what they found out really worked much better was is taking people who were neighbors, people who were close, who actually lived close together, not necessarily that they were of the same age or that they were recently divorced or that they were seniors or their parents or whatever. The important thing was that they lived right next to each other.
That's right. Almost every church in America has a small group movement, which means that you take your worshipers and you divide them up or allow them to sign up for groups of 8 people or 10 people. And you can, usually the way it works is these are affinity groups. They're people you have something in common with, recently divorced, as you say, or you know, young single men or recovering alcoholics. And you study the Bible together and you meet every 2 weeks to talk about personal issues in your life and how you might respond in ways that are more Christ-like. And Willow Creek Community Church, which is probably the single most influential church in the United States, had polled its membership and found out that many of its most mature believers, the people who were sort of furthest along in their spiritual growth, were really unsatisfied with how these groups were working for them. The problem was they just didn't see these folks often enough to develop the kind of relationship that allowed them to speak honestly and to really bring up the issues they were struggling with. You see folks every 2 weeks, and you have to drive across town, and you have to get a babysitter, and sometimes you don't feel that motivated to go to the meeting. So what Willow Creek did was it established a new form of these groups, where the people in your group would be people in your neighborhood. And the point of that was so you can see them a lot. So you're not just doing meetings together, you're actually doing life together. That's what Willow Creek said. And you were supposed to have dinners together fairly often, but also do other things. You know, take your kids to events together, see each other at the grocery store. You might have a group of just the men meeting to talk about what was going on in their life, or just the women. You were supposed to be able to really form a community that was close-knit and where so you could feel comfortable with people, and you had the power to hold each other accountable. And the way to do that was through this neighborhood groups. And this had mixed success at Willow Creek. It requires a lot of time, and one of the problems with using the social cure in middle-class America is that it does require time, and time is one thing that's in very short supply. So a lot of people at Willow Creek just said, look, this really isn't for me. But many people really did like these groups and got into them, and I followed a couple of groups that used this, and they really found that it was tremendously helpful for their own spiritual growth, that it really allowed them to get to be more honest, to really get beyond deeper, dig deeper than just the surface, and really deal with the issues in their lives.
We have about 10 minutes left. I just want to make sure people listening, if you want to call, send an email. You can do that here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The address for the email, if you'd like to write us, is will-talk@illinois.edu. And talking this morning with Tina Rosenberg, her new book is Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. Just again, one other example, because I really like it, and maybe it would appeal to people who are listening to us here, because this is a university community after all. This was about a program that was developed at Berkeley and now actually has been taken out of there. It was a program that was developed to try to help minority students who were in college calculus and having a really tough time. And apparently these are even students that when they were in high school, they did well in math. So that it wasn't exactly the issue. But that, again, it was another one of these things that talks about the power of the group. And it used a really very simple idea, is that they had students study together in a group.
That's right. Yes, this is now in use. Well, it's spread to about 150 different universities, and I think one of them is University of Illinois Chicago also, and it may be in use at Champaign-Urbana, I'm not sure. But the idea was that you had a lot of minority students, some of whom had not only done well in math in high school, but they had done well in calculus in high school. And in college, they were taking essentially the same class, and they were getting D's in it. And the question was why. So there was a math graduate student in the 1970s named Uri Treisman. And he asked math grad students to identify 20 kids who were doing relatively poorly and 20 kids who were doing relatively well. And as it turned out, the 20 kids who were doing relatively poorly were all black, and the 20 kids who were doing relatively well were all Chinese. And so Treisman moved into their dorms, and for the next 18 months he filmed them and watched them study. And what he found at the end of it was that the black kids studied alone, and the Chinese kids studied in groups. And this made a huge difference. And so he set up special sections of calculus. You had the same lecture as everybody else, but you had your discussion section that met once a week. And in these sections, it's not remedial in any way. You would do extra challenging problems, but you would do them in groups. You would split into groups of three or four kids, and you would help each other do them. And the effects of this were, this worked in varying ways. First of all, if you had to be able to explain a problem to your friend, then you had to know it pretty well. And you felt more comfortable asking questions. I think in a lot of cases, especially minority kids who feel that they're in danger of being stereotyped as being not good in math or being stupid, are not going to raise their hand in a large group and ask a question that they think may be a stupid question. But you are going to ask it when you're sitting with three other students. And you can also see whether it's something that the other students also don't understand. So you feel more comfortable being wrong. And some of the kids who were in these groups told me they also felt more comfortable being right, because a lot of minorities had gone to high schools where they were liking math was definitely not cool. And for the first time, these groups allowed them to form math friends, people with whom it was okay to get into math. And the effects of this were tremendous. Minority achievement in calculus just soared. If minority students in these groups score at Berkeley today 3/4 of a grade point higher than whites and Asians who are not in these groups.
that just, I think it's a wonderful example, but it also raises the question of how it is that, how it is that people find one another. That is, for whatever group you think you'd like to belong to, or whatever the issue is, I can imagine that sometimes the big problem is, well, how do I find the other people who are, if I decide I want to try to do this myself, or you even decide as a matter of policy, whether you're a school or government or whatever, how do you manage to find the people and then get them together?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's less of an issue at a university because the math department knows, who are the students who might benefit from this, and they can bring them all into the class. Which helps, because sometimes people are a little shy about reaching out to someone else. If you're not from a culture where you study in a group, it's kind of awkward to call another student and say, hey, do you want to study together? So to have the math department form these groups for you is a big relief. But I think in many cases, we know we have friends or colleagues who we know are struggling with the same issues, and it's not that much of a stretch. I think if I sat down and thought about who I could reach out to, if I wanted, for example, to have an exercise buddy, it wouldn't take me long to come up with a list.
We have one more caller here. I want to make sure we get in the last few minutes that we have. Someone in St. Joe, and this is line one.
Hello.
Hello, yeah.
She is saying much more eloquently something that I've been saying for years. I come from a big family, and just yesterday someone asked us how we did something. And my sister laughed and said, because we're a team. There are things that I can do that she can't and things she can do that I can't. And we've always gone through life that way. And in my church, which is very small, the same thing happens. There are things we can do. I'm middle-aged. I like to match up with people who are much older than me and people who are much younger than me, because everyone who's at the same stage of life seems to have the same problems. And there are things that older people know that younger people don't know, but there are skills that younger people have or capabilities that they still have that we've lost as we've aged. And I just think that it's so much better if people of all ages and diverse backgrounds try to solve a problem together. And I also wanted to speak to the pill-taking issue. I'm recently going through a health problem. And there are two problems. The doctors and nurses don't really seem to have the time to listen to your responses and understand what you're saying. I had a doctor say, I know you don't like to take pills. I know you don't like to take medicine. That isn't true. I have difficulty taking medicine, finding which is the proper time. Now that I've authorized my husband and my children to have access to my medical information, which I didn't realize that I had to do, now I can say, is it almost time to take my pills? Can you help me with that? Can you see that I did it? They're more than glad to do so, just as you said. Whereas my mother, who was totally on her own, they talked about her dementia and how bad it was. Well, they wouldn't pair anyone with her to say it's time to take. If she wasn't in an actual facility, there was no way for her to know what time it was, whether it was time to take her pills, which pills to take. And some elderly people have a huge amount of medication.
That's a really great story that you're telling about, how you hit on this strategy on your own. I love it. And you raised an excellent point, which is that doctors are really not the best people to help us with our adherence problems, in part because they don't have time. 10-minute office visit, you're not.
And often they don't have the same background. They don't understand.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
They
are not people like us. And a lot of people who are not comfortable telling a doctor why they don't want to do something or even admitting that they're not taking their pills are comfortable when they tell that to somebody who is a peer.
It's hard to say. It's hard to be willing to say, I'm just confused, doctor. I this pill works. The last one you gave me didn't work. This one seems to work, but I'm confused about what you want me to do.
That's right.
Well, again, I thank the caller. I need to kind of jump in here because we're getting to the point here where we have about a minute or so left. I guess I'm thinking about looking at some of the things that you write about in the final chapter of the book and talk about how you could apply the same kind of thinking to, for example, trying to prevent kids from joining gangs or to provide some kind of support network for people who have recently out of prison. Or, you know, any other number of things you should think of. I can imagine some people on the one hand saying, well, the goal is laudable, but it makes me nervous that what you're doing is you're putting together groups of people. You know, do we really want to get to put together a club of people who are just out of jail? Could that facilitate them working together to commit new crimes? Or if we get kids together to prevent them from being in a gang, well, aren't we just making a new gang? That kind of thing.
Well, these are problems where the bad behavior was caused almost 100% by peer pressure. I mean, we know that's why kids join gangs, because their friends do. And criminality is very similar. And there's many, many proven stories of how groups that provide a more positive peer pressure help people get out of this kind of behavior. And I see your point. I mean, you get nervous when you put, you know, convicted felons together. Mm-hmm. But the way that these work, and there's really great examples of this in San Francisco with the Delancey Street Foundation and in New York with the Fortune Society, is you find people who also want to change their lives. And you enclose them in a group of people who want to do the same things. And they're not going back to their old neighborhood. They're not falling back into their old ways. Most people get out of prison with good intentions, but those intentions very quickly dry up because they fall back into their old patterns of living. And if you can really surround people, like for example, in New York, the Fortune Society has housing, and you can live in this place, and everyone else there is trying to do the same thing as you, and it's been very effective.
We must stop there because we're here at the end of the time. One more time, I'll say the book to read if you'd like to find out more is Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. It is published by W.W. Norton by our guest Tina Rosenberg, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She also won the National Book Award for her book, The Haunted Land, Facing Europe's Ghosts After Communism. And Ms. Rosenberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, David.
And you have been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This is a show we first broadcast in April of last year. This program, many others, are available on our website, and you can go there and listen anytime you like. It's will.illinois.edu. We will be here on Monday, but we'll be also bringing you some archives. In the first part of the program, historian Maya Jasanoff talks about her book, Liberty's Exiles. And this is a book about what happened to Americans who were sympathetic and supportive of the British after the American Revolution. She makes this argument that, in fact, a lot of them left the country. They went to Canada. They went to other places and were very instrumental in the expansion of the British Empire. That's the first hour. And then the second hour, we will be talking about the ways that African-Americans who fought in World War I got a taste of life outside of the United States, how they reacted when they came back and were confronted with American racism, and the importance of people who were involved in fighting in World War I in the civil rights struggle in the United States. So that's what we have for you on Monday. And then, of course, we'll be back on our regular schedule with new live shows on Tuesday. And again, you want to check the schedule, go to the website. It's will.illinois.edu.
Join hosts Gary Sinise and Joe Mantegna for a night of remembrance featuring an all-star lineup of dignitaries, actors, and musical artists in performance with the National Symphony Orchestra. The 23rd annual broadcast of the National Memorial Day Concert airs live from the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol before a concert audience of hundreds of thousands, millions more at home, and to troops around the world. Watch the National Memorial Day Concert Sunday night at 7 on WILL-TV.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Well, that's it for us on Focus. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine, and here's Craig Cohen.
Hey, David, thank you very much. In the next hour, we're going to have more on the Illinois General Assembly's passage of steep Medicaid cuts
as a step towards balancing the state budget. Also, the cable channel TBS is now leading all ratings among cable networks for 18 to 49-year-olds, and they are doing it without a single original program in prime time. We'll tell you about the economics of reruns. Those are some of the stories on our way in the next hour. Also, a quick reminder, during the next hour, you can join in on a live online chat about WILL's election coverage. That's at willconnect.org. We want to know what it is you want to hear, see, and read from us between now and the November election. What issues should we cover? What should we ask candidates? What races matter to you most? Let us know. Join the online chat. Again, that's starting at noon, about just a few seconds. And again, that goes till 1 o'clock at willconnect.org. Let's take a quick look at what's happening on the